Talk is Jericho's The Plot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and the exclusive home of the critically acclaimed Duff McKagan Joke of the Week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling here. I hope everybody's doing well there. Hey, listen, did you hear about the guy who invented Tic Tacs? They say he made a mint. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Oh, that's a stinker. But thanks to Duff for bringing the laughs every Friday. And thanks to everyone who's come to see us on the Spotlight on North America tour. Fozzie, we've been on the road for the last few weeks. We've got a few more shows left on this tour. We're in Madison, Wisconsin tonight, Friday, November 3rd. We're playing District 142 tomorrow night in Wyandotte, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. That one is getting close to selling out. We're at Versailles, Ohio on Sunday, November 5th. And we close out this leg of the tour on Monday, November 6th in Memphis, Tennessee. Just go to FozzyRock.com to see all the tickets and ticket information. Of course, we're doing our famous VIP meet and greet. It's the best in the business. We meet you, take pics, play a private set of songs that you're not going to hear later on that night just for you. You can even sing if you want to. It's a great, great time. So come to FozzyRock.com and join us. And join us in the UK as well. Spotlight on the UK kicks off February 16th in Newport, Wales. Tickets to all the shows and the meet and greets are available now at FozzyRock.com. All right, speaking of rock and roll, it's all about the rock today on Talk is Jericho. I got Luke Spiller from the Struts making his TIJ debut. They got a new record that just dropped today. It's called Pretty Vicious. It's a great record, cool party vibe. Just like seeing the Struts live, I'm a big fan. And you can get Pretty Vicious, listen to it wherever you buy or stream your music. And the Struts are touring. They kick things off tonight in Las Vegas. Follow them on Instagram at the Struts. Now, Luke is talking about the making of the new record, the impact that COVID had on the writing and recording process and on the Struts business overall, telling some great stories about his experience performing with Brian May and Roger Taylor of Queen at the Foo Fighter drummer Taylor Hawkins tribute concert. Great Paul McCartney story as well. Hilarious. Luke and Taylor were really good friends, and Luke explains how their mutual love of the band Queen started that relationship. So there's some details about a project that he and Taylor were working on just before Hawkins' passing. Luke also talks about teaming up with David Bowie's piano player Mike Garson to do some special shows earlier this year, what it was like to really learn and sing Bowie songs in a super intimate setting with basically just a piano. Once again, the McCartney story is hilarious. Gotta hear it. Let's turn the mic over to one of my new favorite frontmen and one of my new favorite bands, the Struts, talking about Luke Spiller right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. Good to see you again. It's been a while. I think the last time I saw you was in Philadelphia or something like that, some kind of a festival, and I watched you guys tear it up and became an instant fan of the Struts on that day, about 2 years ago or 3 years ago probably.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Philly sounds right. Was it something to do with WMMR?
Yeah. I think it was us and then you and then Joan Jett.
That's like it. That. Yeah, I remember. Because I had black hair at the time, I remember trying to get a picture with Joan Jett and for some sort of cringy post, like, you know, finally reunited, you know, something like that.
But things have been killer for you guys, man. And once again, congrats on all the stuff that you've been doing, all the success. And of course, the new record is Pretty Vicious. And it is pretty vicious, but it's so cool because it's a little bit different from what I was expecting in the best possible way. It's got a real kind of more of a, is it a poppy sound? Is that what I'm hearing? Almost an In Excess type of a vibe at times. Kind of explain what you guys have done on this, because it's a killer record with a little bit of a different twist for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess when we started working up a bunch of demos and we were in sort of, if you want to call it, writing mode, I do remember really vividly, this would have been about 18 plus months ago, just really expressing that we need to really make an effort to kind of push forward and do things that are a little bit more unexpected, met with a couple of things and songs that like our fans would really like, love and adore, people who have been with us and followed us for, you know, over 10 years. So we were kind of mindful of pushing things forward, but yet keeping like our hardcore fan base still at like the center of our attention. And songs like Pretty Vicious, for instance, yeah, it's kind of like got this like you said, it has like this like In Excess vibe meets like British indie kind of vibe.
Right.
But I love all of that, you know, and Pretty Vicious, for example, the song, one of the reasons why I really wanted to make it the centerpiece of the record, called the album that title, for instance, was that I feel like it's a really great, strong song. And it's not us trying to sort of rip ourselves off, trying to do something like Kiss This or Could Have Been Me and all these kind of things, because we've done that. And I think we sort of stumbled on something really special that was totally unique that we hadn't done before. And it was like, that was the kind of thing I wanted to emphasize. So, yeah, and there's loads of little moments on the record like that. But in terms of the sound, I personally think it has a lot of elements of what we're really known for live, which has been something that a lot of, yeah, again, going back to the fans, a lot of the fans have always been like, oh, you know, we love the records, but like the what we feel and experience live is never quite that when we listen to it. So we really wanted to try and get something that had way more of a punch and just a real live feel to it.
And it does have it, because like I said, when I saw you guys live, it was really, you know, we have that vibe too. It's a real party type of an atmosphere, and the music fits that. And that's why, you know, I'm a big fan of you guys. Like I said, and you know, a song like Be a Prima Donna Like Me Tonight is like such a killer type, pompous, you know, it's very much, I don't know, you think a little Freddie Mercury, it's got a little Rod Stewart, it's a little Mick Jagger-ish, you know, and you have elements of that on this record as well. Like we're talking about a song like Rockstar, for example, it does have that.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of like just the way that even that you're dressed, it's very 70s rock, but it's so much fun, which is something that is creeping back into music now, but it wasn't for a long time, especially when you guys started that vibe. Wasn't really there. I mean, you had like a darkness that was happening, but other than that, it was still very serious. But this is much more of a fun party type vibe that I get from you guys.
Yeah, exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head. That was something that we were also really mindful of, was we noticed quite a big shift in the musical climate from when we first arrived onto the scene, so to speak. And, you know, we had the pleasure of taking bands like Greta Van Fleet out for like their first tours and sort of seeing them really like develop. And even more recently with a band like Maneskin, for instance, that have really sort of tapped into the cultural zeitgeist. And yeah, it's a very different time for rock music. I think there's been a real big explosion and want for live sounding guitar based music that really hasn't happened in quite a while. So that was definitely something that we wanted to be mindful of, because to me, honestly, when we started writing the demos, I was like, man, let's just do something really different. Like, let's make a whole record like Pretty Vicious, for instance, and get really kind of dark and groove based. And, you know, that was sort of met with sort of like, all right, Luke, well, calm down. Like, you know, just just remember that it's been a minute since you've been able to really work on a record, and everyone's really wanting you to win and the band to win. And they're waiting for something that they can latch onto, and they want those really great rock songs. So I had to sort of like restrain myself a little bit in terms of how much we were going to sort of like push forward sonically. But I think we got a really great balance with the record.
No, yeah, and like I said, and still expanding kind of your musical palette for that. So who did you work with on this record to create these songs? Is it just all within the band, or did you have the producer working with you?
The collection of demos that we had, admittedly, really span quite a timeline. There are a few songs like I Won't Run and Rockstar, which every band, I'm sure you have them as well, these kind of like songs that have existed for quite some time, but for whatever reason, you just can't really get them right. Mm-hmm. Whether it's like the lyric or the arrangement, even like the key, for example, with those two songs, for instance, it was like, okay, we've got the studio time booked where we're going to go in and track this album. And myself and Adam, the guitar player of the Struts, we sort of like heard these really early versions of those two songs. And we were like, we've got to get this right because the world really needs to hear them. So with the pressure of the studio knowing that it was like going to be coming up in 2 or 3 weeks, we were like, okay, we've got to do this now. And we rearranged both of those songs. We really looked at the lyric. In the case of Rockstar, we completely started again lyrically. And it was like, finally, like we'd done it. So those two songs were pretty old ideas anyway in their skeleton format. Some of the songs, like Pretty Vicious, for instance, and Do What You Want, were written just before our third album, before COVID happened and everything. We kind of just kept them in our back pocket for a while and lived with them. And when it was time to choose what songs we were really going to hone in on the days of the tracking when we were in Nashville, we still listened to those and we were like, no, these are still really, really strong. And then some of the songs like Too Good at Raising Hell and Better Love, for instance, were really, really new songs that we had done just before the recording process. A song like Give Me Some Blood, for instance, was just myself and Ads, and Adam had a chorus and sort of like a rough verse melody, and we collaborated on the arrangement. And when we were in Brazil at some point, that song sort of like formulated that way. So it's this real mixture of brand spanking new ideas with things that have been floating in the Struts ether for quite some time. And I think because of those reasons, it could be one of our strongest bodies of work, because the ideas are so realized and some of the tracks we've really lived with, and they still felt great even sort of 5-6 years on.
You know, what's amazing to me too is how big the Struts have become, and with not a lot of radio play. You know, radio is so important. Like for our band, radio has kind of been a lifeblood for us in helping us get to a certain level, you know, top 10 singles and you know, top 5 singles and that sort of thing. And Struts have never really had that. It's just been just blowing up, almost word of mouth type of a vibe.
Yeah, I think when we first initially came out to the States, 2015, we had like a really healthy amount of radio attention surrounding Could Have Been Me and Kiss This, our really early singles. Mm-hmm. The second record, we had like a similar bit of attention, but honestly, everything kind of really slowed down. And I think this went for a lot of people, and I'd be curious to hear what you went through. But when the pandemic happened and we shunted all of the dates for the tours that we had booked, which we were really looking forward to, and we couldn't really get out on the road for the best part of at least 18 months, it definitely took us back quite a few steps in terms of all of the hard work that we've put in since arriving to the United States and touring all over the world off the back of our debut album. Yeah, I think since then, this year particularly, for instance, has been the Struts working and clawing our way back to where we were in 2019, just before everything collapsed. And we've done it. We managed to book another amazing sold out show at Pier 17 on this last tour. Something that we were doing in 2019. We've done some incredible shows, and people were starting to really come back, and we sort of entered the public consciousness in another new, fresh way. So I'm really proud of myself and the rest of the guys for doing that. But it was really tough when everything kind of closed down.
Yeah, it certainly was, especially when, like, for you guys as well, internationally even, you know, had such a good name for like, for us in the UK. And like you said, you kind of had to start over again. But the fans are back, which is great. Mm. And that's why it's the perfect time for this new record and this kind of resurgence of rock and roll and resurgence of people just going to shows again, you know?
Yeah, I honestly feel like this year, I know we're coming to sort of like the end of it, but we've been touring it quite well and we've done some brilliant, brilliant runs. And for the first time in such a long time, I was like, I don't want to use the word normal, but
yeah,
it really kind of felt like things had sort of, the dust had settled, the paranoia sort of surrounding everything had sort of like eased off, and I can really sort of feel that fans now are coming really back with more enthusiasm than ever because they've obviously been deprived of it, or they were anyway. Yeah, it kind of feels normal again, you know, touch words.
So let's talk about kind of the origins of the Struts and talk about kind of you as a musician and who kind of were your favorites and that sort of thing. Because like I said, there's so many different ingredients into the Struts recipe, which is, you know, every band has that. But I really just, for whatever reason, really dig your guys' vibe and what you do with your influences, et cetera. So kind of talk about, you know, your early years of becoming a musician and who you really were into.
Well, it all really started when I joined like my school band, which so many people do. And I would highly recommend it to anyone who is like 13, 14 years old. Getting together with your mates and starting a group is just such an amazing way to grow up in those really important years of your life. And I was lucky enough to have that. At the time, I was on this real journey of just being obsessed with everything that was 70s, 60s, that kind of era. For instance, like Queen and The Darkness were kind of like my first real musical obsessions. I remember really getting into Queen the day after I went into a record shop in Bristol where I grew up, and I saw all of these albums in the CD section by Queen. I was like, bloody hell, they've done a lot. And I made the conscious decision. I'm like, right, I'm going to go from the debut and I'm going to buy that now. And then I'm going to soak it all in and go chronologically. And I did that over the span of like a year. And I was just sort of like blown away. I loved the diversity and everything. I obviously really admired the musicality and obviously Freddie's voice. It's funny. It's like once you really fall in love with one particular group, you know, you sort of like read up on them, you buy magazines, you read through their interviews, and it's like they mention their influences. And then I would suddenly go and check them out. So with Queen, it was like I was suddenly looking at Hendrix, for instance, who was Freddie was a massive fan of. And then later I'll go on to discover like Led Zeppelin, which again was a massive obsession for quite some time. And then fast forward like a bunch of years later, after the school band really wasn't doing a lot and everyone was breaking off to university, I don't want to say I was giving up on a musical career, but it just really wasn't working at the time. And I had no one particularly inspiring to work with.
Right.
And I was about to head to London and try going to like drama school, which was something that I'd always enjoyed at college, for instance. And I had a message from my previous manager who had heard a song from school band's MySpace page.
What was the school band called?
Oh my God. It was called Fluke Star.
Fluke Star?
Yeah, it's so bad.
So bad. My band was Scimitar. Nettle.
If you have a school band, it has to have just a terribly cringe name that, that you're so stubborn that you can't change it because you're convinced that, like, you know, the world's gonna fall apart like if you change your identity.
You gotta draw the logo on your school books and everything, and it's so serious, man, that we're going all the way. These four guys, we're gonna be together for 40 years.
Absolutely. But you know, that again, this is going back to what I was saying, it's all part of the experience, which, you know, definitely inspires you later on down the road.
So they heard on MySpace, they heard your song.
Yeah, so he heard my song and was really interested, like who wrote it, etc. And I obviously told him that I'd written it, and he was like, okay, do you still want to pursue some sort of musical career? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I do, actually, the more I think about it. And he told me that he'd been in communication and sort of like mentoring this guy called Adam Slack up in Derby in the Midlands, and his band and whatnot. And the band was kind of, you know, fizzling out at that time. He encouraged me to go meet Ads, and I ended up traveling to meet Adam. And, you know, we just hung out and wrote a couple of tracks, and we were just really encouraged by our management at the time to sort of just keep working with each other and just keep sort of like building. And before we knew it, we had like a record deal after recording this demo, a CD with like three original songs on it. Yeah, we kind of like built the band relatively quickly after that, and then began the creative process for the debut record pretty soon after that.
What was the vibe like in England at the time when you were starting out? Was it a good scene there?
It wasn't bad, actually. It really wasn't bad. It was just very different from what we were doing. You had bands like the 1975 were still coming up, and I remember the band was living in a house when their debut single Chocolate came out and went to number one in the UK. So they were sort of like having a moment. And then there were bands like Peace, Temples, Tribes that were kind of all coming out. And I guess it was a little bit of a UK indie like resurgence in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like look wise and sonically, it was like so different from like what we were doing. And to be honest, you know, we got a lot of kickback from even our label at the time, and sometimes even the people around us and management for the way that I wanted to dress and the way that I wanted to present myself and
really
present the music. Yeah, it was really challenging. And in fact, the song Could Have Been Me was really born out of that feeling of frustration that I didn't want to sort of go along with the trends, and I wanted this group to really stand out and have like a real vintage look and sound, because that's just what I was really into at the time. And it's really curious to sort of see now with those bands that I mentioned earlier, like Maneskin and Greta Van Fleet, and there's more like Dirty Honey, for instance, and even this great band called Max Satin that we've got out on the road. They're all really embracing the look and the vibe and everything that I was really like pushing sort of like 12 years ago. So it's funny how everything goes round in this amazing circle.
It makes me laugh, though, that a record company or whatever would be pushing back against somebody who wants to do something a little different, because that's kind of what rock and roll is based on. You know what I mean? Like, and that's one of the reasons why, once again, I was into you guys and got attracted to you, because the look that you had was so cool and different from most. That's what you want.
And exactly. I mean, that wasn't it wasn't the absolute reason why I wanted to do that. But I was also really conscious of the fact that if you look at the music industry and you're a band that's coming up, I do really feel like it's important to stand out and be unique. And
of course, yeah.
Every single band that, like, you know, you and I love, for instance, when you read up on their early years, it's very rare that they were sort of really going along with like a particular trend, either musically or visually. They were sort of like out there on their own. And sometimes it takes everyone a minute to sort of understand it and get it. But yeah, that was exactly what I wanted to do as well. And it just goes to show that when it comes to an artist's gut feeling and their first instinct, that tends to be the right thing to act upon. And, you know, admittedly, there have been times like in my career, especially when I was younger, I'd get talked out of things. I would doubt myself and sort of second guess myself. And it's something that I've sort of learned to really sort of embrace and understand, because like you just said, it's like for the reasons that I felt passionate about, you took a look at the group and was like, wow, what is this? Like,
yeah, exactly.
And heard it. And so in some ways my instinct was correct. So I think it's important for especially young artists to really have faith in their own vision and rely on their gut instinct and follow that, because, you know, the suits and the labels and whatnot, they really don't know anything until it sort of blows up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Then they're geniuses.
Yeah.
We had that with our song Judas, where when the record was about to come out, I was insisting that Judas be the first single. And they wanted another song. And I was like, this is the one. Like, if I was a fan,
yeah,
and this song came out after 3 years of waiting, I'd go nuts for it. A little bit of an issue finally I got my way and the fucking thing went gold and became our biggest song. So like, we know deep down inside that this has a chance, because you never know for sure, right? But this is the instinct that I have, and much like you, it worked out the way you wanted it to, you know?
Yeah, but on the flip side of that, there's definitely been a few moments where I've got it completely wrong.
Oh yeah? Like what? Tell us.
For instance, this might be because of my lack of experience, and I was pretty naive and green at the time, but when we were writing and recording the debut record, Could Have Been Me, for instance, was a song that was done and written quite later in the creative process. And I remember when it was being really sort of realized and the very first demo of it was done, and I was singing all of the big gangs and singing the lead. And I went outside with ads for like a cheeky cigarette, and I said to him, you know, as you normally do, like when you're sort of one on one, when you're outside and the producer's not there, I was sort of like, you know, what do you think of this? And ads is like, I think it's really good. And he's like, what do you think? I was like, I don't know. Like, I'm not quite sure. Sometimes you just don't know what's sat in front of you. And I've also begun to also recognize that as well. Like, the idea that I have sometimes, how I want to present the group in terms of like a single, for instance, I have to also sort of try and remove my own preferences and sort of keep in mind that, you know, sometimes a song or a certain type of song can promote a record and be way more accessible than other choices of tracks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I sort of will always sort of listen to reasonings for as well. So Could Have Been Me, I had no idea. I was like, yes, yeah, it's good. And then it comes out and it just goes, and it's still to this day, like giving and getting synced and being sung on like in movies and everything. And
it's a platinum record.
Yeah.
That I see, which is a million copies sold or equivalent streams of. So that's a huge hit for you guys.
Exactly. I got a platinum record completely wrong. So there we go.
Have you ever had a chance to meet any of your big influences? I mean, a few of them aren't with us anymore, but a lot of them are.
Yeah. I had the privilege of attending and performing at the Taylor Hawkins tribute show. I felt so honored and lucky to be a part of like Taylor's incredible send off. And I was lucky enough to front this super group of Queen and the Foo Fighters like mixed into one. And that was absolutely crazy. So you had Roger Taylor on the drums and Brian up there on guitar, mixed with Dave and the rest of the Foo Fighters. And that was just like insane at Wembley Stadium in front of 80,000 plus people. And I got to sing We Will Rock You, the fast version from their live album, Live Killers, which was a version that me and Taylor used to do with his covers band, Chevy Metal. And that was just, I've said this kind of before in other interviews, but you know, there's no other way to describe it really, but it was one of the most bittersweet experiences I've ever had in my life, where you're all there on this incredible day with an incredible audience to sort of remember and send off like this incredible person who was equally an amazing musician as well. And you're also, you're really sad, but then like, it's amazing and inspiring to see so many people gather for one person and for one specific cause. And then to think that just before Taylor died, for instance, you know, 4 or 5 weeks before, we were rehearsing together, getting ready to do a bunch of shows where we were going to look at the early Queen stuff and really sort of dig out the deep cuts and do a bunch of shows like that. We Will Rock You, fast version was one of them, for instance. And to think that it went from this to that was just really mind boggling. And one of the saddest days in my life, but yet at the same time, one of the most incredible days. So it's a really unique, bizarre thing when I really think about it, you know?
Yeah, it's like the highest of highs, but it's also based on one of the lowest of lows, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's so strange. It's so strange. Again, it's not something that I would like to ever sort of like live through again. But at the same time, it's like I got to live out a childhood dream.
No kidding.
I got to sing pretty much for, you know, the remaining members of Queen that are still active. And one of the most incredible experiences was just before going on stage, I had this knock on my dressing room door, and this lady said, "Brian wants you to come to the dressing room." I was like, "Oh, okay, well, I'll be gone." Bang, shot of tequila, because I was a little bit nervous at that point. So then I go down, and, you know, Brian's there and Roger's there, and I hadn't met Roger before, so I shook Roger's hand and sort of had a bit of a moment to myself where I was like, bloody hell, this is actually happening. And I said, "Is everything all right? You know, are we good?" And Brian's like, "Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to make sure you were here for the walk to stage with us." And I was like, oh my gosh. And it was showtime, and I remember walking through the backstage area at Wembley with myself and Brian sort of leading the pack to the stage, and I just suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this is so surreal, because when I was growing up at that time that I was talking about earlier, I would watch these videos of like Freddie and the band, like backstage at MSG doing the walk. And there I was doing the walk with like my heroes. And it was so incredible.
And doing the walk in the same stadium where, in my opinion, the greatest gig of all time, Queen at Live Aid, took place. And here you are, you know, some 40 odd years later, singing with Queen at Wembley Stadium. Like, that's unbelievable.
It was amazing. And then, you know, to sort of even go full circle with Live Aid, we had Bob Clearmountain mix the entire show, who did Live Aid. And it was like,
oh, wow.
I mean, I've heard it. I've been to Bob's house because he lives out here in LA. He invited me around, and he was like, I really need to show you what I've done. I was like, okay. So I go into his studio. He has this big projector screen with the footage, and I haven't seen it since it had been performed. And he does everything in like Atmos kind of mixing. So he made me sit in this one specific spot in the studio where I was sort of like at the prime position to experience everything. And my God, it was incredible. It was like the closest thing to reliving it that I could ever experience. It was like the power of the music and the crowd. It literally felt like I was back at the stadium again. It was quite emotional. But he's done an amazing job with mixing that show. And what you expect, I mean, it's Bob Clearmountain, so yeah.
Well, and just so many people were on that show. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like you said, and I want to ask you about Taylor in a second, but did you get a chance to see anybody else around there? Because everybody was there.
Mate, it was insane. Like, I remember my dressing room, I had Brian Johnson to the left of me, and then I had Justin Hawkins from The Darkness, like, a little bit further down to the right. Who, again, like, I'm massive fans of, and meeting Brian was so, so cool. And he was such a nice guy. And yeah, gosh, like Lars Ulrich as well. Like, he was such a sweetheart. Just everybody. I remember there was this really surreal moment. There was like this big kind of party after the show. I was sat there with Rush on my left, and then. And then Josh Holmes from Queens of the Stone Age was there, who we sort of really got on famously during the week leading up to the performance. And then there was Paul McCartney. We were all sat on this sofa just talking and having a few little drinks and whatnot. And I was hitting this vape at the time. And Paul turns around and he's like, what's that? And I was like, oh, it's a vape. And he was like, is it weed? And I was like, no, it's just tobacco. And he was like, oh. I was like, do you want to try it? And he was like, yeah, sure. So I passed it to him. And it was a flavored one. And he was like, ooh. And he seemed to really enjoy it. And then we all sort of dispersed and sort of like said hello to other people. And And every 10 minutes, Paul would come up to me and be like, he would sort of just grab it out of my hand. And carry it. And then one time, this is as weird as it gets. He went to go and grab my vape and he was having these little martinis. And he spills the martini all over my lapel on this suit that I was wearing. And he's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And he begins to try and like suck it like out of my lapel. And I'm like, what is going on? I've got Sir Paul McCartney like stealing my vape and sucking on my lapels. But you'll be very pleased to know that I did keep that vape and it sat on a shelf in my room. And everyone's like, what? You know, they'll be like, what is this random like vape you got? And then I'm like, no, that was sucked on by Paul McCartney. That one, that I'm never getting rid of that.
You've got the McCartney DNA if you ever want to clone him.
Exactly. You know,
behind me over here, I have a mic, the foam head of the mic that you put on that Gene Simmons bit off the mic and spit it at me.
Oh, amazing.
I kept it with, you could still see the saliva mark on there. So yeah, I get it. You know,
yeah, you gotta look, every dinner party needs a good show and tell of like a couple of like rarity obscure objects that mean something to us, you know.
You mentioned playing with Taylor and Chevy Metal. I didn't realize that you guys did that together. Any good memories of Taylor? Obviously just a sweetheart of a guy and a great musician and a great singer too.
Yeah, man, like from the get-go, me and Taylor just really like hit it off, and he was such a huge Queen fan that we would just sort of geek out all the time about Queen. And very quickly he sort of like befriended me and then introduced me to obviously his covers group, and I would sort of get up, and I remember we did this really great performance at the Corbin Bowl here in LA, and mm-hmm. that was like a super special night. And from then on, it was sort of like whenever I was available and whenever sort of like our paths could cross, we would always sort of try and get together and do something and play shows. And honestly, the main reason I ended up making the move to LA in 2019 was because of Taylor. I was lucky enough to be invited by him to his Thanksgiving. It was then he sort of sat me down. He was like, look, you've got to get out here. You've got to sort of like do this and get into the thick of it. And I'd never really considered it before then. And I was like, oh, I don't know. And he was like, look, come on, do it. And I was like, I really should. I was like, you know, this age, I should really do it now while I can and whatnot. And very quickly after that, I ended up moving. I just rented a room from one of Taylor's friends, Brent Woods, who it was in Chevy Metal, and that was it. And my kind of life, my professional life as well, really changed because I'd already had some sort of a social infrastructure in terms of like producers and people that I knew. All of a sudden, everyone was like at my fingertips. That really helped for not just me, but the rest of the band become way more productive and actually sort of like go out and socialize and sort of like become really sort of relevant in the scene, like in LA. And yeah, he changed everything for me. And I evidently, like I owe him a lot because he was a really, really great person. And beyond all of that, he was like such a fan of music. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that separates the good from the great in the music industry, is like when you speak to these sort of like legendary people who have really sort of become masters at their craft. And a lot of the time they don't even realize they are, like Taylor, like, you know, he was still pushing to become better and better and better. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he was sort of incredibly humble. And I think people found that incredibly endearing about him. But yeah, you speak to these massive legends in music and rock, and you can just talk to them for hours and hours about who they fell in love with musically at an early age. And they still are looking for that next song, and they're still looking for like that next artist or that next band that's going to make them feel something. You know what I mean? And it's like, right. you can recognize that in people now, you know?
Well, it's one of those things too, Luke. Like, we're all just fans of music. And usually when you meet somebody like that, it takes, you know, one or two meetings to get over the fact that I was like, oh my God, I'm talking to, you know, Paul Stanley. And then after a while, it's just that he's just a dude who has a cool job doing what we do, having fun and having, you know, creating awesome music. And there's a real kindred spirit amongst all of us once you get over that, oh my God, it's so-and-so, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's just been such an incredible journey. And I feel so lucky to have met and worked with a lot of people that I really idolized and like adored when I was really getting into rock music. And every now and then I sort of wake up and definitely have like these kind of pinch me moments.
So something else that's interesting that I wanted to ask you about, actually my producer, Stacy, went and saw you. You sent it to me, I guess, about a year ago, of you doing Bowie songs with Bowie's piano player. Is that who it was?
Yeah, it was Mr. Mike Garson.
Right, Mike Garson.
Who I believe, from what he tells me, he is the longest standing member, musical collaborator that David Bowie ever had, because he loved to obviously change things up. And Mike actually joined for the Spiders from Mars tour and pretty much continue to work with David in the studio and on tour up until pretty much when David passed away. So I think it was 40 plus years that he'd worked with him.
Yeah.
And I'd seen this clip, I think it was on Instagram somewhere, but it was at this really cool new place at the Sunrose, which was in Sunset in LA, which is attached to this really cool members club called the Brightly. It was him playing, I think it was Jake Wesley Rogers, who I also really, really think is amazing. And they were doing these Bowie songs. And it was like Bowie sort of, I wouldn't call it like tribute, but it was almost like I could see he was inviting different singers to sort of like do these shows. And I was like, wow, I need to do this. So I got in contact with him really quickly after that. And we just sort of like settled on a couple of dates and we designed these sort of shows, which were a collection of songs that were really sort of thought about. And we mixed like my favorite Bowie tracks with a couple of contemporary people that I really love and respect and a couple of other songs. And there were a couple of original songs as well that I had written by myself, which I had the chance to sing in front of like a small audience with just my voice and the piano, which really sort of inspired me after that. And very quickly, that's kind of led to myself. Even this week, I've just been working on a solo record all because of that experience where I just thought, wow, this is really unique and special. Just stripping everything back and relying way heavier than like being in a band on the lyrical content and the melody. So those shows of Mike were really inspiring and such a great thing to be a part of.
How was it singing Bowie? Obviously such a unique singer. What songs, because there's so much diversity in his voice as well and different styles of music. I mean, he's the template for that.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that he was a great saxophonist from like what I'd heard. I didn't fully appreciate his sort of vocal melodic metering until I had to sort of like really sit down and listen to the songs, more so than I have ever had done previously. And once you sit down, you're learning like a Bowie track, whether it's anything from Spiders and from Mars or the latest stuff, even Hunky Dory era, you really can understand and appreciate the fact that he is also a player, because he kind of uses his voice more of like an instrument rather than sort of like a singer, because the placements, he like starts on the beat, he starts behind.
Yeah.
There's something really free flowing about it. And it's not always like on the grid, which a lot of popular music does, or traditional rock music, for instance, where it's all quite symmetrical. David had this like incredible way of approaching almost every other line in a different way from the next. And yeah, it makes interesting and amazing to listen to, but having to sit down and sing it, you realize it becomes really kind of like tough. It's like, oh my gosh, this kind of goes against all of my usual basic instincts I've done previously.
It's interesting when you cover bands, and like you mentioned, you hear a song and you think you know it, and then when you realize you got to sing it, like you said, it's a whole different world, because I can totally tell what you're talking about with the Bowie phrasings, you know, and the syncopations for sure.
Yeah, and then on top of that, working and performing with Mike, who is essentially like a jazz pianist. He obviously played a lot of rock stuff, if you want to call it that, with David, and a whole wide range of different genres that David always, you know, dipped his toes into. But he's really free-flowing, and there's no real like tempo when it's just you and him.
Mm.
When he's playing the piano and I'm singing, the best way I can describe it, it's kind of like this wave of back and forth where he leads and then I sort of sing, and you're constantly like feeding off each other, and the tempo is just doing this like woo, like depending on where in the song you are. So that was something that I had to learn really, really quickly, and something I hadn't done for years and years and years since singing in my school jazz band. So that was really cool. And I think after those gigs, I sort of came out feeling a lot more confident about my musicality and the way that I can approach songs. And I definitely think it had an amazing positive effect on the Pretty Vicious album, because I was sort of approaching the song slightly different, thinking about the vocals a little bit different, and not being afraid to be a little less symmetrical than probably what I'd done before.
Yeah, that's one thing I always enjoy when you play with different musicians and you kind of expand your horizons a bit. I think that's a good thing. That's one thing, one of the few positives about the pandemic was a lot of that started happening where I started an 80s non-makeup Kiss cover band and singing those songs, you know, like it's hard to sing that stuff because I don't sing like that in Fozzy, but it really helped kind of expand my musical palette, so to speak. And that's what playing with other musicians can do that for you.
Exactly. It's all great, valuable learning experiences. And whether it's was doing all of the stuff with Taylor, you know, doing these shows with Mike, and of course, like with the Struts as well, it's like I feel like I can really bring quite a lot of experience now. And I think to sort of like go back to the album, like slightly, I feel like the dynamics in the record, in terms of like the song choices and the way I'm using my voice, I would say is probably the most diverse we've ever recorded on a body of work. And it makes for a really interesting listen.
No, I agree. Like I said, there's a lot of different styles on it, which is it's a very easy record to listen to.
Mm.
And obviously you're going to be playing it live. So you have some touring coming up that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually start in Vegas, which is the day the album comes out. So that's going to be a really tough day to not sort of go out and have an absolute rager. Like being in Vegas and performing the day the album finally drops and, you know, your sort of baby is released to the world, so to speak. So I'll have to try and behave because it's right at the beginning of the tour. And as you know, sometimes if you end up having a big rager, like at the beginning, it will take you like a week to get over it, you know, because you're just in tour mode. So, but yeah, I'm looking forward to these dates. We start in Vegas and we pretty much end in LA just before we break off for the holidays. So it's going to be really, really great.
So how is that for you once again, like when you're on tour? Because that's one thing, you know, I have to be careful too, because I like hanging out with people and doing stuff. And obviously the worst thing you can do when you're on tour is go out to a club or something after where you have to kind of talk loudly and strain yourself even more. So how do you find the happy medium?
I feel like going sober during a tour for me is what really works. I'm not saying I'll go completely dry for the entire thing, but for 95% of the tour, I'll try and just not touch alcohol. And out of my own experience, I've sort of found that it not only helps me to kind of cope with the various sort of struggles that you can have on tour, whether it's sort of exhaustion, last minute things that get set up, and suddenly the schedule turns really hectic and you're on planes every other day.
Mm-hmm.
Not drinking just really helps me out. So I do that. And then I tend to sort of do a lot of cardio on my days off and just sort of take it easy on the show days. And I get a little nap in while the rest of the band sound check. So that's sort of like my time to sort of like rest, you know. But yeah, that tends to be what helps me get through it. And honestly, like, it took me a while for me to realize this, but up until about 2018, I hadn't ever sung or got up on stage sober since I was about 16 years old.
Wow.
And I remember doing... It was just this sort of like diet that I was trying, which sort of led into the tour, sort of bled into the tour. Like, and I wasn't drinking during it. And I remember doing these a few shows and thinking like, bloody hell, like I feel so much more in control and my voice is way more powerful and I feel like I have way more stamina. And then I just didn't want to drop that new level of expectation that I'd sort of experienced for myself. So then, for then on, I sort of have realized that what really, truly makes me happy more than anything in the world is getting onto the stage and knowing that I've done my absolute best under the circumstances in which I've been given. Doing that sober, for the most part, really just sort of like helps me to achieve that. And I walk off stage and I'm like, I did it. Like, I really felt like I was really sort of like on it tonight. It makes me appreciate the show more as well. Like, I'm so much more aware of like my audience and what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read that. And I think it's made me a better frontman and performer, dare I say it, ironically, you know, because I think people have this preconceived idea of the rock singer and the front man, whatever. And, you know, they want them stumbling around on stage and sort of like snarling at people. But that's not really, I guess it's not really my style. The way I can describe it is like, if someone says to me, why don't you drink, you know, before you go on, like, don't you need like to get in the zone? I'm like, well, imagine drinking half a bottle of tequila and then going on a 6-mile run. Cause that's what it feels like.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Last few questions for you, Luke. You mentioned the front men. Who are your favorite front men that influenced you or that you like right now?
Obviously, Freddie's definitely up there. I always loved Robert Plant. I thought he was incredible and super unique. Bon Scott was also one of my favorites.
Hmm.
You know, and the three of them are like really different, but like has such character. Of course, Mick Jagger is someone who is completely unto himself and is just such like an inspiration.
Yeah.
But then again, there's also other people as well, like Scott Walker, who I really love and adore, and who just have like these incredible voices. And I tend to really love and admire singers that can do things with their voice that I could never do, whether it's sort of like a certain type of vibrato or the range. It's sort of like those are the singers that I really tend to listen to. But I would definitely say those four were definitely key in different types of genres as well. Like James Brown, like I was obsessed with. I just couldn't get, I mean, when I started watching some of his live concerts, I just couldn't believe how tight and well rehearsed and how much of a musical leader he was. You know, doing those gigs, and it kind of blew my mind. I was like, this is so great. And then, yeah, I guess the more like kind of recent people would be, you know, Justin, obviously from The Darkness, I adored when they were coming out and still do. And Pele from The Hives, I think is an incredible, incredible performer.
Good call.
And yeah, I'm always kind of on the lookout for new people, you know?
Yeah, man, that's a good call with Pele, with The Hives. I was a big fan of theirs, gosh, probably 15 years ago. Last question for you, though, Luke. What's your favorite song on the new record? I know it's hard to kind of pick just one because they're all your babies, but which ones stand out for you and which ones are you looking forward to playing live?
I mean, I'm looking forward to playing. I think we're doing about 5 or 6 new songs from the record in our next set. In terms of the songs that I really love, I honestly, a bit of a basic answer, but Pretty Vicious, I'm really proud of. I love the way it builds. In fact, it's my mum's favorite song that we've ever done, which is actually quite funny. Yeah, I have no idea why. And she just starts air drumming when she starts listening to it. But I love the way that that song builds. And then when I jump up the octave on sort of like the vamp at the very end of the song, it sort of like goes, yeah. And it's, the guitar solos are really great. And I love the production. But then I Won't Run as well. I'm really looking forward to performing that. And I'd say those two are sort of like my favorite tracks on the record.
Well, dude, like I said, it's a killer record. I like Rockstar. That one stood out to me. And I also really liked, like you said, Pretty Vicious is great too. But the whole record is awesome. And it's awesome talking to you. And I look forward to seeing you again soon, hopefully on the road. And we can hang out and have some tequila, as long as it's not a show date.
Yeah. No, exactly. It'll be fine, mate. Tequila all the way. I'll happily break my tour sobriety for you to have a couple of shots, for sure. I promise that.
All right, dude. Well, congratulations, man. And we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much, mate.
Cheers, Luke.